with last week. Remember, the first thing we dealt with was the fall of Jerusalem under Nebuchadnezzar. And you remember how God had said that it was going to be completely destroyed. It was going to be like a cup or a plate, something that was a dish rather, that was going to be wiped out and turned upside down. Complete and utter destruction. All the people taken out and the whole place destroyed. And that's exactly what happened. Everything was taken away from the temple. There was absolutely nothing left. And the whole place was completely cleaned out, just as God had said it would be. And then we followed on to find out what exactly happened to the people. Remember how Jeremiah, first of all, we deal with him, how God had said that Nebuchadnezzar had said that he was to be taken great care of, because he had faithfully preached the gospel, he faithfully told the people what God had said, that they were going into exile, even under when they were being attacked by Nebuchadnezzar's army. And they didn't like it at all. Remember, one time they put him down a pit up to his arms in mud and that, they wanted to kill him. But he continued in spite of all this. But at the end of it, you remember how Nebuchadnezzar had said that he was to be taken care of, and he'd instructed the chief of his army, the commander of his army, to make absolutely certain that he was properly taken care of. And the commander, when he found him amongst the other captives, he took off his shackles and everything, and he said, "Now, you can either come home with me to Babylon, and I'll take great care of you, or you can stop here with the people, or you can do whatever you like. You've got a wish. You can do whatever you like. These are the orders I've been given by Nebuchadnezzar." But he had a tremendous opportunity. Imagine how it must have felt for him after all he'd been through. He was the offer to go to Babylon, and he could have had a life of luxury there, but he didn't choose that. He chose to stop with God's people, the ones that were left behind, not the exiles, the ones that had been left behind in Jerusalem, the poor and all the rest of it, even though they treated him so badly. And so that's what he eventually decided to do. And then remember how the Nebuchadnezzar appointed a governor over the land, a very nice man, and he was very kind and everything. And everything went well for a while. Incidentally, during that time, all those that have fled to their neighbouring countries, they all came back, because the governor had promised them that nothing would harm would come to them, and he would intervene between them and Nebuchadnezzar. He said, "Come back and you'll be well taken care of." And that's what they did. And they all flocked back there. But unfortunately, there were amongst them, there was an evil man named Ishmael, and he, with other people, they murdered the governor. Jeremiah had warned the governor again and again that this man would do this. He said, "Look, be careful, because he's a treacherous man." But the governor, very nice chap, but a bit too naive, he wouldn't believe him. But that's what happened eventually. And then the people then, when they saw what had happened, they were terrified, because they thought, "Well, now Nebuchadnezzar is going to blame us for this." And so they decided to run for it, to flee, leave the country. And they decided to go down to Egypt. And you remember, they set out, they all got together, and they set out, and they got as far, I think it was Bethlehem. And then Jeremiah had been telling them, "Don't do this." But they wouldn't listen to him. And Jeremiah, he wasn't even then going to leave them. He went with them. And he got as far as about Bethlehem. And then they turned to Jeremiah and said, "Please pray for us to make see what God wants us to do." So Jeremiah prayed to God, and God told him. He said, "Look, if they stop here," God said, "he would look after them. They've got nothing to fear whatsoever." And this is the message that Jeremiah gave to them. But it wasn't the message they wanted to hear. And they turned around and said, "You're a liar. You're not telling the truth." And they wouldn't listen to him. So they persisted, and they decided to go down to Egypt. Jeremiah carried on with them. He warned them all the time that was going to happen to them. And when they got down into Egypt, again he warned them. He said, "You've fled from Nebuchadnezzar in Jerusalem, but you're not going to escape. You're not going to escape the sword, because it will follow you into Egypt." And that's exactly what did happen eventually. But while they were in Egypt, they turned, as you would expect them to do in a heathen country really, They turned to all kinds of idolatrous worship. Jeremiah tried his best to bring them back. He warned them about it. He told them. He said, God will punish them and all that. But they just wouldn't listen. And that's exactly what did happen to them eventually. Because Nebuchadnezzar, or the Babylonians rather, later on, they pursued right down into Egypt. And there, when they attacked Egypt, they killed most of the Israelites that went there. A few of them escaped. Always a remnant, remember, escaped. Incidentally, the end of Jeremiah, we don't know what it was, but the old legend was they got so fed up with him preaching about God and that, and telling them what kind of life they should be, that they eventually stoned him to death. Well, it's true or not, we don't know. But that's the kind of the life, I think, a wonderful character, Jeremiah. But that's one side. Now, what happened to the others who went into Babylon, who were taken into exile? Those that were taken into exile, they were taken as prisoners, and it must have been terrible for them at first. But they very soon settled down in the new country. And before long, they became Babylonians, really. At first, they found it quite hard leaving their country. And remember, I told you about that psalm by the waters of Babylon, how they must have wept, and how terrible it was to have left their country behind, left their city, and be taken thousands of miles away into this foreign land. But they eventually settled down. And as their children grew up, of course, would not know anything about Jerusalem, the ones that were born there, because it went on for 50 years, they very soon started to forget all about the hardships and that. But they never forgot Jerusalem. And they had the prophets there, like Ezekiel, who faithfully preached to them and taught them and led them back to God. And the whole purpose of God sending them into exile was not only to punish them, but to punish them with a purpose, to bring them back to him, to get rid of all this evil within them, all this idolatrous worship and such like. And it was working. After a while, we hear how they gradually, as God had told them to Jeremiah, to settle down, to marry, to get their sons and daughters to marry, and to settle down in the land, because God had put them there. He'd used Nebuchadnezzar to get them into the land there, and they were going to be there for a long time. So he said, settle down. Remember, also, there were a lot of lying prophets who were always saying, no, this is not God's word, and such like. But this is what God had said, and this is what's going to happen. And they were stopped there for 50 whole years. And in that time, they became a completely changed people. It was a death for a rebirth. And in the rebirth, they were cleansed and clean, and they became back to God. And it was the start of the small meeting places, and which were later dates had the Greek term name of synagogue. But this was the time when they started getting together and getting back to God. And it says they sang praises and they listened to the word of God as they never ever had done before in the old days, in the marble halls of the temple and such like. But in these small little places there, they really turned back to God. And the people now were a changed people. And this went on for 50 years. And at the end of 50 years, as God had said, the time had come. He told them that they would be there for 50 years. But at the end of 50 years, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, he didn't give the name Belshazzar, because they said his grandson, that will be the end of time, and he would bring them back. God had given them this promise through Jeremiah all those years before. And in Isaiah, nearly 200 years before, he told how that the man who bring them back would be Cyrus. He was going to raise up this man Cyrus. And God did that. And after 48 years, it wasn't 50 years exactly, because they weren't returned, Cyrus attacked Babylon. Belshazzar was the king then, grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And he overthrew the Babylonian Empire. And now Cyrus was in charge, the Persian. The Medes and the Persians were very close together. They worked together. First of all, the Medes were the most powerful. And then eventually it came back that it came to more or less to Persia. But they were all interconnected and they worked together as a mighty empire. Now, Cyrus, he knew because everybody knew all about these prophecies, and he must have known that he was the one appointed by God to do this. And so Cyrus arranged for them to go back into Israel to, after 2 years, at the end of the 50 years exactly. 48 years he attacked and overthrew the Babylonian Empire, and 2 years later he gave the edict that they were to go back. And they were to go back to their land, and more than that, they were to take all the treasures back that had been carefully stored all these years. Remember, God had said that they would all come back, all these treasures. Normally, what when the Babylonians and the others conquered a nation, they'd take their gods, their idols. But of course, there were no idols. So they took the next best thing, which was all the treasures of their... The idea being that now their God is our God. But at the end of the 50 years now, they were to take them back, all the people. And he not only gave that, he also gave instructions that they were to have everything they needed on the journey. And when they got there, they were to have all the things they needed to build the temple, which included the great cedar trees from Lebanon and such like. All these were to be made available to them. And then at the, they all gathered together then, but not all of them wanted to go back. In fact, there was only about a total of about 40,000 of them went back. Most of them, they were so comfortable in the land, they decided not to go back. They were going to remain in the land with their children, where their children had grown up. And remember, most of them had been born in Babylonia, in different parts of Babylonia. So really, although it was they'd heard from their fathers and their grandfather what it was like, they'd never actually been to Jerusalem and to Judah. And so they decided to stop in the land. But they gave their wish, they gave lots of gifts to the people going back, and also their good wishes to them. And so eventually this great caravan of people, 40,000 of them, with all their things they were taking back, they went back, started on the way back to Jerusalem. Now it's interesting to note that through this, the people that went back, they were still as a nation. They still had all the records of who they were, because it was vital that we knew who were the priests, so that they could do the sacrifices and everything. And all these records were kept. You've got a list in chapter 2 of all the different people that went there. And so the whole company numbered 42,360. That's besides the other, so it was really, would probably be about 50,000 altogether went back, wouldn't it? And that's where we finished up last week. They were now back at in Jerusalem. And then if we read now on verse 68 of chapter 2, when they arrived at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, some of the heads of the families gave freewill offerings towards the rebuilding of the house of God on its site, according to their abilities. They gave to the treasury for this work 61,000 drachmas of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priestly garments. The priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants settled in their own towns along with some of the other people, and the rest of the Israelites settled in their towns. Just a few words about that. They gave according to their abilities, and notice they were free will offerings they gave. This is an example to us. We should never give to God anything because we feel we ought to. They didn't give because they felt they ought to give it, because they gave because they wanted to give. And if we ever give anything to God, whether it's tithe or whatever it might be, we do it because we love God and we want to give it to him. And notice how most of them, even though they were born in Babylonia and had never seen their parents' previous homes, yet they knew exactly where they used to live. It had all been kept very much alive to them, even after 50 years. The nation, like a plant, was still complete and was being replanted in its original soil, as God had promised they would be. They were going back as a people, not as a rabble. It would have been so easy just to go back a rabble, not knowing who were there, but they knew exactly where they were and everything. This is what the work that the prophets had done, like Ezekiel and that. They kept them together. There were other prophets not named there as well. And they'd all kept them all the time. They never forgot. So they went back still as Jews. In Babylon, they'd been Babylonians, but they were Jewish Babylonians. And now they were back in their land as Jews. They'd never lost their identity, which is a remarkable thing, really. It never happens like that in practice. Now we come to chapter 3 of Ezra. The first verse. When the seventh month came, and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. It would have been very easy for them after their long trek. Remember, they had to walk. They did have some horses, probably the old people and the children, but most of them had to walk the whole distance. And we could say, oh, let us take it easy for a few years so we can rest and enjoy it. And then we'll fulfill, then perhaps at the end of that, we'll feel like the strenuous job of rebuilding the temple. It was a tremendous job to do this, to build the temple. But well, they weren't like that. They were a different people now. They may have been like that before they went into exile, but now they were a different people altogether. They were sincere in their belief that they were God's special people and he was their Lord and their life. So as soon as they had settled their families in their homes, they had to settle them down first, they all, and notice all, not some of them, they all gathered together as one man in complete unity to begin the task of rebuilding the temple. This unity of purpose shows how changed the people were from 50 years ago. Remember, in 50 years ago in Jerusalem, they were arguing and fighting against the other, pro-Egyptian, and all the false prophets and everything. They were a real mess up in Jerusalem, but now they were different. They were young, they were in unity all together now. And it's a beautiful picture. God, because of their stiff-necked, arrogant and sinful life, full of quarrels and evil behaviour, God had sent his judgment on them. But they were now ready as one people to serve their God with all their hearts, just as the true people of God, his precious chosen people, his representatives to the world should be. It's a picture of ourselves, what the Christian church should be. But look at it, with heresies, distress and all the rest of it. But that was a beautiful picture of how it should be. Verse 2 and 3. Then Joshua, son of Jozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his associates, began to build the altar of the Lord of Israel, to sacrifice burnt offerings on it, in accordance with what is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Despite their fear of the people around them, they built the altar on its foundation, and sacrificed burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both the morning and evening sacrifices. The first thing they did was not to start building the temple or even to start ordering the materials, because a lot of materials had to make arrangements for everything for it. But the first thing they did was to set up the altar in the correct place so that the burnt offerings could be done exactly as ordered and laid down by God. They were going to make absolutely certain that God was going to be put first in everything before they did anything at all. Is this worship of God. Do you remember Abraham did this when he went into the promised land? Let's quickly look at that. In Genesis 12, after his long journey from the Ur of Chaldees and eventually landed in the promised land, this is the first thing that Abraham did. 12 and verses 6 and 7. Abraham travelled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. The Canaanites were then in the land, but the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Right at the very beginning, the first thing they did, they put God first and his worship right at the beginning, before they tried to do any work at all. Verses 4 to 6. Then in accordance with what was written, they celebrated the Feast of the Tabernacles with the required number of burnt offerings prescribed for each day. After that, they presented the regular burnt offerings, the new moon sacrifice, and the sacrifices for all the appointed feasts of the Lord, as well as those brought as freewill offerings to the Lord. On the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, though the foundation of the Lord's temple had not yet been laid. Then they gave money to the masons and the carpenters, and gave food and drink and oil to the people of Sidon, and Tyre, so that they would bring cedar logs by the sea from Lebanon to Joppa, as authorized by Cyrus, king of Persia. In the second month of the second year after their arrival at the house of God in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, son of Shadon, Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who had returned from captivity to Jerusalem, began the work, appointing Levites 20 years of age and older to supervise the building of the house of the Lord. Jeshua and his sons, descendants of Hodaviah, and the sons of Henadad, and their sons and brothers, all Levites, joined together in supervising those working on the house of the Lord. They then continued to start the elaborate system and sequence of offerings, just as laid down in the books of Numbers. It's quite an elaborate system, this, you remember. It's in chapter 29, we won't turn to it now. Now, the system of offerings and festivities were set in motion even before the foundations of the temple were laid. The worship of God was going to take absolute priority over everything. Before they did anything, God is going to come first. My worship of him before I do any work at all. And then they set ready to start the building. They were now ready, when they've done that, to start the process of ordering and arranging the delivery of the materials, and appointing the masons, carpenters, and supervisors to make certain that everything was done correctly. They obtained the huge cedar required. Do you remember we talked about this when Solomon built the temple, first of all? They had to go to Lebanon to get the huge cedar woods that only grow above a certain height in Lebanon. There was none around that would be suitable for the great spans for the temple. They got those, and that was ordered. Remember how Cyrus, the king of Persia, had made provision for this. Then verses 10 to 13. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple, the priests in their vestments and with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, took their places to praise the Lord, as prescribed by David, king of Israel. With praise and thanksgiving they sang to the Lord. He is good. His love to Israel endures forever. And all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy. No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise, and the sound was heard far away. Now there was great rejoicing, with everyone joining in. All the priests, it's not a quiet, when you praise God, it's not quietly done, is it? All the priests correctly robed, and the musicians praising God for all they had done for them, singing psalms of praise to God. Incidentally, just have a look at one of the psalms. This is one of the psalms they probably sang, Psalm 100. There's a whole list of psalms here, praise psalms that they'll be singing. We'll give you some idea of how they were singing. Psalm 100. Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving, and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him, and praise his name. For the Lord is good, and his love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations. Can you imagine them all singing like this? And there were, if you go further on, there are a number of other psalms like that. They were singing, they were having a terrific time, praising God for all that he'd done.
They sound like those Christians.
Yes. There were, however, some older ones among them who had known the original temple, and they wept, knowing that the new temple could never equal the old one in all its glory. But their weeping was drowned out by the shouts of joy of the people, celebrating that they were now back at God's appointed place, and he was in the midst of his work. God had brought them back as he promised. You remember the great joy. We're back again. After all these years, 50 years, they're back in their land, and their temple was going to be built. Right, now then, chapter 4, verses 1 to 5. Now we see the other side. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of their family and said, let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God, note that, your God, and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. These were the people who had been brought from the other, from the far reaches of Assyria to repopulate the land. But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the family of Israel answered, you have no part with us in building the temple of our God. We alone will build it for our Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. Then the people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now this chapter is very important for us to describe the reason for the tremendous hostility that developed between the Samaritans and the rest of the Jews. It continued for hundreds of years. It came right down to Jesus' time. Remember, I've talked about this before. And this is where it started, which is where that hostility started between them. The people referred to as the Samaritans were descendants of those people taken from various parts of the Assyrian Empire, whom the Assyrian had brought in to replace the 10 tribes of Israel, who had been taken into captivity and spread throughout the Assyrian Empire. Now, they said they now worship the God of Israel, and so they wanted to help rebuild the temple and join with the returned Judean exiles and their sacrifices. And worship of, note, your God. It didn't say our God, it said, we want to worship your God in verse 2. Now, on the face of this, seems quite a friendly thing, a reasonable gesture for their part, wasn't it? Look, we worship the same God as you. We want to join in with you. We want to help you with this. We'll help you to build the temple. Ah, but was it? Now, I want to see the reason for this. Why? Because there's been a lot said about this, and they've been criticised, even by Jews themselves, for not allowing them to build. So let's turn back, and I want to look in 2 Kings chapter 17, where we can see the reason why the Judeans rejected their offer. So let's turn back to 2 Kings now. Right, 2 Kings chapter 17 now, and I want to read through quite a lot on here to give you the full picture. We'll start in verse 22. There's 2 Kings 17. The Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence, as he had warned them through all his servants the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their home into exile in Assyria, and they were still there. Now, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace Israel. See, they brought them from all the areas of the Assyrian Empire. When they first lived there, they did not worship the Lord, so he sent lions among them and killed some of the people. It was reported to the king of Assyria, the people you deported and settled in the towns of Samaria do not know what the God of that country requires. He has sent lions among them, which are killing them off, because the people do not know what he requires. Then the king of Assyria gave this order, have one of the priests you took captive from Samaria go back to live there and teach the people what the God of the land requires. So one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship the Lord. Now remember, the priests of Israel were corrupt. They weren't worshipping the true God. That's why God had taken them out of the land. So the one they brought back would not be a true worshipper of God, and they could not teach them the proper truth. Then it says, nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the seven... Now note that. Nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the several towns where they settled, and set them up in the shrines of the people of Samaria had made at the high places. The men from Babylon made Sakoth-Benoth, the men from Jakarta made Nigal, and the men from Hamath near Asher made Nibbah and Tyler. These are the different gods they made, you see. And the Servites burned their children in the fire as sacrifices to Adramelech and Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They worshipped the Lord, but they also appointed all sorts of their own people to officiate for them as priests in the shrines of the high places. They worshipped the Lord, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the customs of the nations from which they have been brought. To this day they persist in their former practices. They neither worship the Lord nor adhere to the decrees and ordinances, the laws and the commands that the Lord gave the descendants of Jacob, whom he named Israel. When the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites, he commanded them, "Do not worship any other gods or bow down to them. Serve them or sacrifice them. But the Lord who brought you out of Egypt with mighty power and outstretched arms is the one you must worship. To him you shall bow down, and to him offer sacrifices. You must always be careful to keep the decrees and ordinances and laws and commands he wrote for you. Do not worship other gods. Do not forget the covenant I made with you. And do not worship other gods." See, repeat it again and again. "Rather worship the Lord your God. It is he who will deliver you from the hand of all your enemies." They would not listen, however, but persisted in their former practices. Even while these people were worshipping the Lord, they were serving their idols. To this day, their children and grandchildren continue to do as their fathers did. In other words, they were a multi-faith people. In other words, they considered that the gods of the Israelites and Jews were just another god to be worshipped. Like their gods, "Oh, we've got another god to worship." See how what they were like. This was a direct opposition to everything God had said and emphasized over and over again. Remember the Ten Commandments. The first commandment, "Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shall you must make any idols, you must do anything." And one of the great lessons that the exiles had learned in captivity was never to put anything or anybody in the place of their God, their creator. Nobody was to take his place. And it was said after the captivity that never again did the Jews ever worship idols. It cleansed them from this. So, but what was they bringing them back, you see, with the Samaritans? What would have happened? Now, how did they react to this? Nobody likes to be rebuffed and in effect told they were not good enough. But the Jews had no option, because if they'd let them join in the rebuild of the temple and the worship, it would soon have led them back to the worship of idols with all that it entailed, which had been the curse of the people right down through the ages, and turned them away from the true worship and following God. See what the situation is. And this is quite a warning to us in a way, really, when you get churches joining together. And they say, well, even though you may not agree with some of their doctrines, "Oh, we're all Christians together, we'll all join together." And what happens? They bring in all these other things, and that destroys it. We've seen it again and again. It happens. It's happened in Australia. I won't give you names and all that. But it has joined, and that's what happens. It never does work. You must never compromise in this way. And that's the reason why the Jews would never let the others join in the worship, which is quite reasonable when you think about it. There were the Samaritans, the ones who had been
settled
in the land original of Israel.
And that's mentioned in Kings, isn't it?
Yes. All the way through, we've got this. They've been settled. Now, from this point, this is where it started, you see, and it goes on for several hundred years, for hundreds of years after this. From this point onwards, right to the end of Nehemiah, there is conflict, and nothing that is attempted for God will now go unchallenged, and every possible tactic will be explored to oppose the building, to oppose the Israelites now. They made real enemies there, but they had no option. And that bitterness carried right the way on for hundreds of years. But this is the reason for it. Before it tells of the immediate sequel of all this, starting in verse 23, now just careful to watch this, it digresses to show how throughout the next century, up to the moment of disaster that was to bring Nehemiah hurrying back to Jerusalem, the catalogue of intrigue and slander continued. You see, we're going to go through this now, and this is an insertion put in there to show us what all this meant over the next hundred years. This carried on all the way through. And the insertion, that's from verse 6 to verse 23, gives us a foretaste of the following history, to reveal the full seriousness of the opposition, what it really meant, all this opposition. And it helps us to appreciate the achievements that were recorded in chapters 5 and 6. In spite of all this, they still were able to carry on, you see. Now, I'll give you a brief overview of history now, to give you some idea what was happening here, before we go through that. In the year 530 BC, Cyrus went to battle in the eastern regions of his empire and was killed. He was succeeded by his son Cambyses, who added Egypt to his empire, and then Darius I then succeeded him. I'm going to talk about that a bit later on, but just to give you an idea of what was happening. And it was during his reign that Haggai and Zechariah started prophesying, and in which the work of the temple was resumed. There's going to be a big gap now, you see, between this, in this bit here. They're pushing it, this is history, it's been inserted in here just to show you what's happening here. The next king, Xerxes, is only mentioned in passing as we go through this, in chapter 4, verse 6, though he dominates the book of Esther, and I'll come back to that later. His successor, Artaxerxes, then is the king from Ezra chapter 7 to the end of Nehemiah, together with a mention of Darius II. Now, let's just read through this now, verse 6. But you see this is, you'll get confused if you're not careful. This is not going in time, it's looking forward now, just showing you all the problems that are going to come in the future from this. And then when we get back to verse 24, we're going to go back in time to follow on before the insertion. In verse 6, at the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. The mention of Xerxes just marks the passing of time, which had not cooled, and you show that the enmity had not cooled off in that time. But nothing came of this accusation, apparently, what they did then. Then verses 6 to 23. We'll go right through now. And in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bishlam, Mithra, Tabeel, and the rest of the association wrote a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic script and in the Aramaic language. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshah, the secretary, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes the king as follows. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshah, the secretary, together with the rest of their associates, the judges and officials over the men from Tripoli, Persia, Erech and Babylon, the Elamites of Susa, and other people whom the great honourable Ashpenazim deported and settled in the city of Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. This is the copy of the letter they sent to him, to King Artaxerxes. From your servants, the men of Trans-Euphrates, that's the other side of Euphrates, you see, the king should know that the Jews who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They're restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if the city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes or tribute or duty will be paid, and the royal revenues will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace, and it's not proper for us to see the king dishonoured, we're sending this message to inform the king, so the search may be made to the archives of your predecessors. In these records you will find that this city is a rebellious city, troublesome to the kings and provinces, a place of rebellion from ancient time. That is why the city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are restored, you'll be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. The king sent this reply to Rehum, the commanding officer, Shimshah, the secretary, and the rest of their associates living in Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. Greetings! The letter you sent us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order and a search was made. It was found that this city has a long history of revolt against kings and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates. So referring back to the time of Solomon and David. And taxes, tribute and duty were paid to them. Now I wish you an order to these men to stop work so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter. Why let this threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests? As soon as the copy of the letter of taxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. This letter, and as far as chapter 6 on verse 18, and also chapter 7, verse 12 to 26, is written not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic. This is the only part of the Old Testament that's written not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic. We now move on to about the time 70 years after the return from the exile. This is what it's referring to. It's referring to a time 70 years in the future. So this insert is pushed in to show us what was going to happen 70 years in the future, to show how it affected it. The temple now would have been standing for about 50 years. So it's 50 years after the temple was completed. The walls and foundations mentioned here were not, of course, those of the temple. They were the walls and the foundations of the city itself. The insertion from verse 6 to 23 is put in to show how the antagonism and opposition carried on right through the ages. That's the sole purpose of putting it in there, to show that what would happen in the future years because of where it started from here, you see. Right, now we go on to verse 24 now. We're moving back to the original story now. Thus the work of the house of the Lord in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So that's going from verse 5, you see, before. They hired counsellors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus. The time is now that of Zerubbabel, but we're now told what verse 5 stops short of saying, i.e. that the work was not only hindered, but it was actually halted. It didn't say that there, but we can see now in verse 24, to carry through, that the work of building the temple was now halted. And secondly, in the reign of Darius, the deadlock was broken. Do you follow that now? It's very confusing, this, if you don't get this in the right order. What message do I get out of all this? The one dominant message that comes through all this is that God is in complete control of all the nations of the world and all history. He's not just sitting on the sidelines and letting the nations do just as they want to do. Theologians seem to think that he is... if you read, you know, what they say, it appears that, God is on the sidelines there, he's allowing the people to do it, and then he comes in as he wants to at different times. But no, God is in complete control of the whole history of this world. If that's all you learn out of this, you've learned a tremendous amount. You've got more than most Christians understand. He is in absolute control of all these nations, and he's in control now. Yeah. The next thing to understand that his purposes, all history, and I mean all history, revolves in his working about his special people, which also includes the Christians. Everything that's happening in the world is revolving around the Jewish nation and the Christians. And that's in God's plan. If we can get hold of this, it's not according to what the nations, what they want to do, it's how God is moving them, bit by bit. Looking back on just this short history that we've just been dealing with at this time, we can see how God raised up and used several great nations and people. First of all, he raised up the Assyrians to put the Israelites into captivity and to take them out of the land, as he said he would. Then 130 years later, he raised up the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar to take Judah into captivity, into exile. And that the time appointed, as prophesied by Isaiah, incidentally, 200 years before, he raised up Cyrus to free them and bring them back as a complete people to their land. Then at the correct time, according to his plan, again as prophesied, he raised up Darius so that the temple could be completed at the appointed time. It's all in God's planning. He allowed these things to happen because God had said that the temple would not be completed for 70 years. And so he allowed this to happen. At the end of 70 years, then he raises up Darius. And we can see what's going to happen with Darius then. the pattern shows how God has and is and will control all the nations to fulfill his purposes. And we can trace this right the way down through the Bible, right from Genesis to Revelation. The short interval of time which we're studying now ends at the end of the book of Nehemiah, which is effectively the end of God's revelation in the Old Testament. That's the end of the Old Testament as far as God's revelation is concerned. We then get a silent period of about four centuries before the coming of the Messiah and the opening of the New Testament. During this period, we can see, if we study secular history, including the Apocrypha, how God is still controlling the nations to work out his purposes. I want to go through this just to show you how God is working all the way through. Briefly speaking, we first of all, if you look on here, you see how God has raised up all these different people here, and then eventually we'll see how he raised up, this is going beyond now the Old Testament, we're into the silent period now, he eventually raises up Alexander the Great, the Greek, who imposed a common language upon all the nations. It's a form of Greek that could be easily understood. And then he used the Romans after this, so the roads they built and the way they unified the European peoples enabled the gospel to be quickly and easily spread. This is the only time in history when this was available, when you had the Roman roads to the gospel and also all the people were united. It's never, there was after the Roman Empire fell, for over 1,500 years or so, it was never the same again. And it's only come back in today, in the last century, since we got the freedom of travel and the freedom of language. Everybody in the world understands, most people, they understand English now, because it's the international landing. But if you go back 200 years ago, it wasn't like that. You couldn't travel easily, you couldn't preach the gospel. And you can see how important it is, you see how God is working here. So as you can see how God is using people all the way through, and he's used the British Empire, and he's now using US, Russia, China, and most important of all, the countries of the Middle East. You see how God is working through this. If this is what you get out of this, you can see God's working. Although this is not just interesting history, it is very much more. If we can grasp all this, we will then begin to understand what is happening throughout the world, what it all means, and how it will also give us the correct and key to understanding future prophecy, what is going to happen next. But the one thing that is vital for us to understand is that our God is in complete control of everything, and he's steadily working out his purposes. Have you got hold of this now? God is in absolute control of this world. Everything that happens, you can see it going click, 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 of all the things. If you see it through here, the examples here, how God was working, and he's doing the same thing today. It's not just random, as the world thinks. The world would say, oh, well, it's just history, this. These are things that are happening. But God is in absolute control of everything. It's a shame that many of the theologians don't understand this as well. Right, now we go on to chapter... After doing that, we go on to chapter 5 now. We're back in ordinary time now. The story is complete, carrying on. Verses 1 to 2. Now Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Ada, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God of Israel, who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, son of Jozadaket, set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with him, helping them. The building of the temple had stopped by order of Cyrus. We saw that in chapter 4, didn't we? But now there was a new king, Darius, and the time was ready for the rebuilding to start again. God gives them the order through two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. They've got the order now to start. Now let's have a look. These are the two prophets now who are now preaching to them. Remember, we moved on there right to the end, 50 years now. See Haggai chapter 1. He's got Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai. We'll read through the chapter right the way through, and you can see how this came about. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. This is what the Lord Almighty says. These people say, the time is not yet come for the Lord's house to be built. Then the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Is it a time for you also to be living in your own panelled houses while this house remains a ruin? See, this had carried on for about nearly 20 years from the when they returned. They'd stopped the work. No work had been done. And they were concentrating on their own home. Because instead of Cyrus, they were afraid to do anything further here. But now God says to them, well, you're doing your own house. What about my house? Now, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. You have planted much, but have harvested little. You eat, but never have enough. You drink, but never have your fill. You put on clothes, but are not worn. You earn wages, only to put them in a purse that has holes in it. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains, and bring down timber, and build the house, that I may take pleasure in it and be honoured, says the Lord. You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why, declares the Lord Almighty, because my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with his own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew, and the earth its crops. I call for a drought on the fields, and the mountains on the grain, and the new wine, the oil, and whatever the ground produces, on men, cattle, and on the labour of your hands. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, Joshua, son of Jehoaz, the high priest, and the whole remnant of the people obeyed the voice of the Lord their God, and the message of the prophet Haggai, because the Lord their God had sent him, and the people feared the Lord. Then Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord to the people. I am with you, declares the Lord. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, son of Jehoiada, the high priest, and the spirit of the whole remnant of the people. They came and began the work of the house of the Lord Almighty their God, on the 24th day of the sixth month, in the second year of King Darius. Well, you see the situation. They've settled back in there. They've had Cyrus stop them from building, and now they're carrying on. There's no wrong with building their own houses, and they've virtually forgotten all about building the house of the Lord. But what had God done for them? He was stopped their harvest, everything they did now. They turn around and say, well, why is this all happening to them? Because God now says, I want you to build my house at a point in time. And he'd used the prophets to bring this message to them. But see how they responded. Immediately they responded to this now. And it's beautiful to see it. The building of the temple had been stopped by order of Cyrus. But now there was a new command. The time was ready for the rebuilding to start again. God gives them the order now through the two prophets. Verses 3-5. At that time, Tatania, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar Bozenia and their associates went to them and asked, who authorized you to rebuild the temple and restore the structure? They also asked, what are the names of the men constructing the building? But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped until a report could go to Darius and his written reply be received. They got problems now. The intervention came as soon as it was clear that the builders were in earnest. It was quite understandable, as the whole empire had been seething with revolt for the previous 2 years. I'll tell you what happened here. After Cyrus died, Cambyses, his son, inherited the kingdom. And what he did, he went down, one of his first things to do was to go down and attack Egypt. And he added Egypt very quickly to his empire. But before he did that, he killed his brother, so there could be no argument about the successor who would come next to the throne. Now, this caused no end of problems afterwards, because when he died, who was going to be the successor after him? And this went on for different people trying to get the succession, until Darius, very strongly, he took over. And so for 2 years, there'd been all this kind of turmoil in the nation. So that was the situation it was like, you see. This sudden local activity, they thought, well, was this just a temple that they were building, or was it something else? Why did they need such huge stones to build it? And it was the duty of the provisional governor appointed by Darius to find out what it was all about. Are they trying to rebuild? Are they going to build the city again and revolt again? You see, they had to find it out. His attention was drawn to it probably by the local opponents, who were rushed to tell him. You can imagine them, oh, we've got something now, let's do the best we can to stop this. The governor and his associates went to inquire as to what was happening and who gave the authority for it. They also asked for the names of the people involved. The whole situation could have been very nasty now, but as it says, God was in complete control. He had his eye on it, of this situation. And surprisingly, they were not ordered to stop the work while a report was sent to Darius, so they could still continue with it, you see. Verses 6 to 16. This is a copy of the letter that Tatania, the governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates, the officials of Trans-Euphrates, sent to King Darius. The report they sent him read as follows. To King Darius, cordial greetings. The king should know that we went to the district of Judah, to the temple of the great God. The people are building it with large stones and placing the timbers in the walls. The work is being carried on with diligence, and is making rapid progress under their direction. We question the elders and ask them, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and restore this structure? We also ask them their names, so they could write down their names of their leaders for your information. Mm-hmm. See, the idea being that Darius, we know who could blame for it then. That's what they thought. This is the answer they gave us. It's lovely, this answer. We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, one that a great king of Israel built and finished. But because our fathers angered the God of heaven, he handed them over to Nebuchadnezzar the Chaldean, king of Babylon, who destroyed this temple and deported the people to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to rebuild this house of God. He even removed from the temple of Babylon the gold and the silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, and brought to the temple of Babylon. Then King Cyrus gave them to a man named Sheshbazzar, whom he had appointed governor. And he told him, take these articles and go and deposit them in the temple of Jerusalem, and rebuild the house of God on this site. So this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God in Jerusalem. From that day to the present, it has been under construction, but is not yet finished. We can see from the letter how the elders were not afraid to say who they were and why they were doing it. It was a very bold statement to declare that they were the servants of the God of heaven and earth. You imagine standing up and saying this. It's a great shame that Christians seem to be so timid in declaring who we really are in God's sight when we come up against the world. They weren't afraid at all. They were going to say who their God was and why they were doing it. They don't care what the result would be. They then tell them about the decree or the edict of Cyrus. We now see how important this decree was, as it gave them the full authority to do the work. But could it be found? Think of what had happened all this time. Verse 17 now. Now if it pleases the king, let a search be made in the royal archives of Babylon to see if King Cyrus did in fact issue a decree to rebuild this house of God in Jerusalem. Then let the king send us his decision on this matter. King Darius then issued an order, and they searched in the archives stored in the treasury of Babylon. A scroll was found in the city of Ecbatana, in the province of Media, and this was written on it. Just a few words about that. First of all, it's a vast empire. There's huge, great distances. Remember the distances you've got here. First of all, a search was made in the records in Babylon, but they couldn't find them there. So then they went to a place where they knew that Cyrus had his headquarters, and that was right over the other side of the empire, in Media. And it was eventually they tracked them down then. This would all have taken a long time because of the vast distances. But remember, the building of the temple hadn't been stopped. It was still carried on during this time. Verse 3 and 5 in chapter 6. In the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place to present sacrifices, and let its foundations be laid. It is to be 90 feet high, 90 feet wide, 3/4 of large stones, note that, and 1 of timbers. The costs are to be paid by the royal treasury. Also the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, are to return to their places, and in the temple of Jerusalem they are to be deposited in the house of God. The edict given by Cyrus confirmed everything that the elders said it did. It included precise and strict instructions. Now you can see how important this was. Including the positioning of the large stones. This is the thing, the putting of the large stones is to cause all the problems. What are they doing? Are they building a great fortress or something, you see? But this is specifically mentioned there. It also stated that everything removed by Nebuchadnezzar had to be returned and replaced in their correct positions, and the cost of it all was to be borne by the treasury, the national of the thing, you see. All the costs, they were going to finance it all for them. Now verses 6 to 12. Now, that was Cyrus. Now verses 6 to 12, now we have the answer that Darius gives now. Now then, Tatenna, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar, Bozana, and you, their fellow officials in that province, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work of this temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree what you are to do for these elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. The expenses of these men are to be fully paid out of the royal treasury from the revenues of Trans-Euphrates, so the work will not stop. Whatever is needed, young bulls, rams, male lambs for burnt offerings to the God of heaven, and wheat, salt, wine, and oil, as requested by the priests in Jerusalem, must be given to them daily without fail, so they may offer sacrifices pleasing to the God of heaven, and pray for the well-being of the king and his sons. Furthermore, I decree that if anyone changes this edict, a beam is to be pulled from his house. He is to be lifted up and impaled on it. For this crime, his house is to be made a pile of rubble. May God, who has caused his name to dwell there, overthrow any king or people who lifts a hand to change this decree or to destroy this temple in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. After reading the letter about Cyrus, King Darius issues his own decree, which went far beyond anything that Cyrus had said, and all to the benefit of the Jews, you see. The governor and the other officials were strictly warned not to interfere with the work. Furthermore, they were to help them and supply all their needs at the expense of the royal treasury. Severe punishment was decreed on anyone who tried to alter or interfere with the work of the edict. And it ends with the words of the last two verses. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. In other words, let it be done quickly and properly. You do it, it's to be done properly. It's fantastic when you think of this, isn't it? Now, what message do we get out of this? Well, humanly speaking, you could say that Darius did all this because he wanted to ingratiate himself with the God of the Jews. In a similar way as he'd done with the gods of the other nations. What they'd done, he was hoping that these gods would help him, you see. That was the idea. But we know that it was the God of all creation who was behind a heathen king to accomplish his purposes for his special people, the Jews. We have examples of this right through history, right down to the present time. God is complete control of his creation and all of history. Don't make the excuse, you'll read this in some of the commentaries, oh, he only did this because he thought it, but no, he did that, that's true. But over all of this, God was in complete control. He was going to have his temple built, and built properly at the correct time. And he was controlling even this heathen king in this way to make certain it was done. It's absolutely fantastic when you think of it. That they weren't being punished, they were going to be held. Everything was going to be done to make certain it was done. See how God was overruling in this. Verses 13 to 18 now. Then because of the decree of King Darius had sent Tatana, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Barzenia and their associates carried it out with diligence. So the elders of the Jews continued to build and prosper under the preaching of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, a descendant of Ada. They finished building the temple according to the command of the Lord God of Israel and decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar, in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Then the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. For the dedication of this house of God, they offered 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 male lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, one for each of the tribes of Israel. And they installed the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their groups to the service of God at Jerusalem, according to what is written in the book of Moses. The building now continued at a great pace, aided by the governor and his associate, as ordered by Darius. The builders were also greatly encouraged and guided by the true prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to make certain everything was done correctly. The work was completed exactly on time, 70 years. If you work it through, you'll see, although it's, you might see a year or two out, in actual fact, the exact time was 70 years, as God said it would, after the destruction of the first temple. It's quite a lesson to us to see the ticking of God's clock cannot be thwarted or altered in any way. All this, all the people had tried to stop it, and they couldn't do it. God was just using them. And the clock was ticking, tock, 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 until that 70 years was finished. Just a comment here. I believe that God's clock is now ticking again. It started in 1948, when Israel again became a sovereign nation. Think, you see, as it was then, now God is doing it again. They're now back as a sovereign nation. And that clock is ticking again now. And nothing can stop it. And now verses 19 to 22, the Passover. On the 14th day of the first month, the exiles celebrated the Passover. The priests and Levites had purified themselves and were all ceremonially clean. The Levites slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the exiles, for their brothers, the priests, and for themselves. So the Israelites who were returned from exile ate it, together with all who had separated themselves from the unclean practices of their Gentile neighbors, in order to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. For 7 days they celebrated with joy the feast of unleavened bread, because the Lord had filled them with joy by changing the attitude of the king of Assyria, so he assisted them in the work of the house of God. You see, it refers back to it, because Assyria started it all off, didn't he, when the Israelites were taken into captivity. That's why he's mentioned there. He didn't actually help here, but he started the process. Now, in these verses, the language now very appropriately reverts to Hebrew. Up to that point, that being said, it had all been in Aramaic. There was great joy expressed, and by including everyone now, there were once again the feast of the Passover could be accelerated in God's house. This ends the first stage of a generation long of Israel's rehabilitation. It had taken 20 years from the time they'd gone back into from captivity until the temple. So that's the first stage now, the last of the 70 years, you see. It had started when God stirred up the heart of Cyrus and then concluded with God turning the heart of one of the great kings and most powerful successors. On this note of joy, the story breaks off, followed by a long period of silence, about 60 years. So at this point here, and there's a big break now, it's going to be about 60 years between the time of Zerubbabel and that of Ezra. Now, I'll just go through it. Just a thing to make clear to you. Up to this time, this is history that Ezra had got together. He was not alive during this time. Ezra comes. We're going to meet Ezra in person when we come to chapter 7. But there's a gap of 50 years in this between 6 and 7. You follow that, because that can get a little bit confusing there. And the time at that point then, Zerubbabel and the other prophets are finished now. And it's going to be a new time. Because it's 50 years, remember, is a gap. Sometime during that 50 years he was born. Now, during that time of that 50 years, a lot of things had happened. You've got it on your map, in your thing here, you see. Darius had died. Xerxes, he'd taken over as king. And it was during Xerxes' time that we have the story of Esther. What I'm going to do here, we'll do it next week. I'm going to put the insertion here, we should really come here, the story of Esther. Because that fits in this time here, you see. And we'll deal with that next week. And then after that, we'll go on then, picking up the theme again in chapter 7. And that's when Ezra comes onto the in person, and we see what a fantastic character he is, the scribe who recorded, who got together all this information. And by the way, Ezra was the first of the scribes. From then, he was a priest. He was also from the royal family as well. A wonderful character, and we'll see how it all fits in from there onwards. It's quite a fascinating story, this bit, from there onwards. But I think it would be an appropriate point to finish at that.